Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network. I'm Lee Hutchison, and Dallas King and myself make our way through the A24 filmography and along the way bring you interviews with the talent involved in front of and behind the camera. Ahead of Dallas and myself finally getting to see Bodies, Bodies, Bodies next week, I welcomed movie writer for Vulture, Nate Jones, to dive into his two 10th anniversary pieces that focused on A24, looking at the cult-like fandom that surrounds them and diving into his very own 100-plus ranking of their filmography. Thanks so much to Nate for joining me, and you can find links to the articles discussed in the show notes or on Vulture. Enjoy the conversation. So last week, Nate, marked obviously the 10th anniversary of A24, and you dropped two really interesting articles that seemed to catch the attention of people online, looking very much at sort of the cult of A24 and sharing your own 113 films ranked best of list. Before we kind of dive into the articles, what is your kind of relationship with A24 films? Are you kind of similar to that kind of professional that you spoke to in your article and sort of seek out their films opening weekend? Or are you more of a kind of casual fan observer?
I'm a little bit in the middle, I guess I would say, because I am sort of a journalist. I think there is maybe a sort of hesitation to sort of jump in fully into fandom. You know, you want to sort of keep a little bit of distance. But I guess my relationship, it's the same as a lot of people. And that sort of, I saw a lot of their films and liked them. Spring Breakers for me was a huge one. That was one where it really did feel like this sort of generational marker that, like, you know, this is a movie for young people today. And when you are, you know, in your 20s, it hits you very powerfully. And so that was, I mean, that was only their third ever film. And the first two were, you know, a little more, didn't really get huge releases. So that was, you know, like many people, that was the first one I saw. And then, yeah, over the years, you would sort of start to notice, like, oh, they did Ex Machina, they did The Lobster. And then I became an editor. I was the editor of our film section in late 2016. So that was like the Moonlight season, the 20th Century Women season. And so sort of getting that sort of behind the scenes and like planning coverage and all that stuff, that sort of gave me a little more, you know, that sort of makes you have to pay a little more attention to, like, okay, here are the studios that are releasing all these films, because these are the people that you were talking to about, you know, getting screenings and getting interviews and things like that. And that was when I started to notice that, like, in these meetings with all these other film writers, that, like, A24 was like a thing we were talking about. And we were sort of talking about it. It had like a persona in a way that the, you know, other studios kind of did it. And then, yeah, things just kind of went from there. You know, they had Lady Bird, which I loved. And, you know, they had Hereditary, which sort of brought the horror into the mainstream. And yeah, and so it was always something that I enjoyed. And then as time went by and I started to notice, like, their brand building exercises, I don't want to say that it was just sort of thing you would be like, huh, okay. You know, I would say maybe not all of that stuff is for me. But at the same time, you could sort of recognize that it was a very sort of savvy move. And especially in this very cutthroat industry where so many studios go out of business and, you know, it kind of just takes one flop to ruin you. You can respect the hustle while also being like, I don't need to dive in headfirst, you know, into this.
What was maybe like that first moment that you realized that there was like your kind of article that caught a lot of attention last week was like this kind of A24 kind of cult style approach? Was there a moment that you sort of like, I remember sort of being at film festivals and like maybe noticing random t-shirts or pin badges or the idea of like an A24 candle and people spending $50 on that? Was there a moment for you that you were like, oh, this has kind of gone from liking of films or looking forward to film releases to this is a bit odd or cult-like, perhaps?
I will say the moment that sort of crystallized it for me, I forget what year this was. It was probably around 2018, 19. But I was listening to a sports podcast. It was a basketball podcast. I'm from the city of Philadelphia, which is about 100 miles south of New York. And yeah, so it was a basketball podcast around the Philadelphia 76ers, but it's a very loose conversational podcast. And one of the hosts just sort of mentioned that like anything A24 puts out, I will watch. And that was just sort of striking because I live in New York. I'm in the media. I hang out with film critics all the time. So there are some times when I have to sort of take a step back and be like, is this something that like actually exists, or is it just like my little bubble of 100 people who stand outside the theater and talk after screenings? And that was sort of a good crystallization. Like, no, here is somebody who is sort of entirely outside my bubble. Has this guy who is in his early 40s has sort of different interests than me. But it is sort of getting to him, and he is invested in it, and he is enjoying it, and he has sort of pinpointed the brand as something that he is into. And that kind of stuck with me, if that makes sense. That was kind of like, okay, yeah, this is sort of something that is, a little bit wider than I expected.
Obviously, we mentioned like last week was like their 10th anniversary, and it didn't seem to make much of a splash, really. Like, there was maybe the odd like little tweet thing you would see about like, what's your four favorite A24 films? But it seemed like your article kind of was the sort of the main kind of almost sort of celebration or look at sort of A24 kind of films on that sort of anniversary. What was the kind of process for you? We always talk about with often on this podcast with filmmakers and artists, but what was your process, Nate, for like pitching this article and kind of the time scales involved in it?
So it was a very, very long process. It comes out of quarantine. It was mid-March 2020. Movies had stopped coming out. All of us on the movies team were just trying to figure out, what do we do with ourselves? What do we write about? And we quickly came up on like the same thing that a lot of people picked up on, which is, oh, you can write about old movies. People are sort of every the people that we our audience is sitting at home watching old movies, so we can write about that. And so we did a good job in that, but we also sort of were looking for bigger, sort of more ambitious projects because we had time to stretch out. There wasn't that sort of weekly grind of, this movie's out this week, this movie's out, next week. So yeah, so we're looking for big projects, and we had this meeting, and one of my coworkers was like, maybe we should rank every A24 film. And I had done a big ranking before, probably like 5 years or so ago. I did a big ranking of every Taylor Swift song that, I would occasionally
You're
update
going to have to revise that in about a week's time now, Nate, with this new album coming out.
It's very, yeah, with the re-recordings, I had to kind of stop updating it, but now that she's got another new one, it's at the point where it needs like a full top to bottom revamp. So I need to just like take 2 weeks and listen to every song again. But yeah, but anyway, so I had experience in that. And over the years, some friends had sort of mentioned the idea. They'd be like, oh, like that should be the next one you do, is you should do an A24 list. So it was sort of this idea that had been bubbling around. And then my coworker pitched it. And I talked to my editor, like, hey, if this coworker doesn't want to do it, I'm happy to do it. It sounds like a fun project. And yeah, lo and behold, this coworker did not want to watch 100 films and rank them all. She had better things to do with her time, but I did not. And so yeah, so I just started watching them. And at the time, I was living at home with my parents, because of the quarantine. And so yeah, so it started as this thing that we would do together. So my parents are in. They are normal people with normal people jobs, but they were always film buffs, and that is, they were always helpful in sort of in encouraging me to sort of do this and sort of nurturing me as in my own film taste when I was younger. So they were really into it because they, this was something that they'd seen some of the movies, but the idea of the brand they didn't quite know about. So it was a thing that we would go together. So there was, the Wikipedia list of all the films in order, and I would just kind of, if we felt like watching a movie that night, I would go down the list and say, are you into this? And they'd say yes or no. And, I sort of knew their taste, like anything horror we didn't watch. And so I sort of went down the list, and Depending on what was streaming where and what was streaming on Netflix, so luckily I had it all in an Excel spreadsheet to track, like, okay, have I re watched this movie? Have I read the blurb, written the blurb? And yeah, and so I did throughout summer and early fall 2020, I did on a good clip. I was doing probably, I think I was probably doing around like 12 movies a month, so that's, not every day, but it was, a solid thing. And then my other job is sort of the Oscars correspondent, so that you had that weird Oscars year where all the movies were virtual. So I had to sort of catch up on all those, and so I could have put it on the back burner. And then that's kind of how it worked, is like I would put it on the back burner every few months. If I had a break, I would be like, oh, I got to catch up. Of course, they kept on releasing new movies, so I would have to see them. And luckily, I would go to film festivals and I would see like Lamb or Red Rocket, and then I could, bank the blurb that way. So it was good to catch up, but then sometimes, like they released a movie on Hulu and I didn't have Hulu, so I had to like get someone's Hulu. But yeah, and so it was sort of bubbling along, but there was never a specific reason. It was always going to be a thing where I would have to stop working on anything else for like at least a month to finish it, to lock it down. So it was bubbling along, and finally this summer, I think it just looked the way, like, we saw that there wasn't that many movies on the calendar and it wasn't Oscar season yet. And so my editor said, in May, like, hey, like, let's finish this. Let's actually publish it this summer. So yeah, so I basically took, this was like late May, so I basically took all of June to finish watching and writing all the blurbs. So I saw 28 films. It was like a two a day. It was very regimented. It was, you'd wake up, you'd watch a movie around 10 or 11, write the blurb after lunch, watch another movie in the afternoon, write that blurb at night. And I hope it's not obvious from reading the list, like, which blurbs I wrote in June and which ones I sort of wrote when I had a little more time. I think there are one or two. I was reading some comments where someone's like, ooh, that blurb's not very good. And I was like, how did they know? Like, that was a June one. But hopefully it's not obvious. But yes, and so we locked it down, and it was good. And then we started thinking, like, what else should we do with this, right? Like, it's a huge story. It's like 14, 15,000 words. Let's maybe think of some other, let's turn it into like a little package. We were born out of a magazine, so sometimes we still have that magazine thinking of, like, you don't just do one story, you do like one, you do a little constellation of assorted stories. So yeah, so one thing that sort of the easiest thing that came to mind is, why don't we do a feature story about the cult, the A24 super fans. I think at first the working title was like The Rise of the A24 Bro, and then as I sort of started talking to people and doing more reporting, well, we were like, well, that's like, there is sort of a stereotype out there of like the quote unquote A24 Bro, but the truth is that, the stereotype is very gendered, but when you actually meet these people, it is fairly balanced gender-wise, I would say. So we decided, okay, like, let's not do the Rise of the A24 Bro, let's do the Rise of the A24 Super Fan. And then, when it's in the magazine, it just gets a little punchier, so they do the Cult of A24. But yeah, so I spent basically July interviewing people. I did the reporting probably backwards from the way you would want. The original pitch was something maybe a little snarkier, and I thought originally, like, maybe I wouldn't want to speak to any of the actual fans, because, like, I know myself, and I know, like, if I speak to them, I'm going to like them and I'm going to have sympathy for them. And if we're trying to do this very sort of, just a little sort of, I don't know, we had this newspaper probably 10, 15 years ago called, the New York Observer, that was very good at doing these. It was sort of like a predecessor to Gawker and doing these, like, kind of trend pieces that were a little just like kind of, off kilter, a little snarky, but very, colorful. And I thought, like, why don't I just sort of like interview people about the A24 and it super fan, and get at this cultural phenomenon from the outside, and the thought that, like, then you will get a little, you'll have a little bit of a critical distance from it. So that's, I interviewed some writers, I interviewed the podcasters, the Ion Pack, I interviewed somebody from Alamo Drafthouse. And I wrote the first draft and wasn't very good, because we hadn't talked to any of the actual fans, right? And so my, all the edits that came back is like, well, how do A24 fans feel about this? How do A24 feel about this? How do they feel about this? XYZ. And so then it was like, okay, no, we need to actually talk to some fans. Luckily, there is a thriving Reddit community. It has over 70,000 subscribers. And I'd heard through the grapevine that, through my reporting, somebody had mentioned like, oh yeah, like people are so into A24 that they like A24 tattoos. So I just kind of started digging into like people who had posted their A24 tattoos on Reddit, and sort of messaging them, being like, hey, I'm a reporter, would you like to talk? And yeah, so I ended up finding, this woman, Soraya, who was perfect. And she was a wonderful person to speak to because she both embodies what the A24 fan is, and that she has a very powerful emotional connection to these movies, and she loves them, and she loves the brand, and she has, it's not a hype beast thing for her. She has a personal connection to this art, which I think is something that's like really great. And if you care about film as an art form, that's what you want. And sort of in just like who she is and the way she is, she sort of dismantles a lot of these stereotypes of who she, she's not a 24-year-old kid on Canal Street wearing a Supreme hoodie. She's just sort of a normal person who has a normal IT job in the Midwest. And so she was good to be like, as a counterpoint, that like, hey, like we make jokes about the A24 ban online, but like when you actually drill down and talk to the real people, like they are very different from this. And then, yeah, and then I posted a general call, just like, hey, if anybody wants to talk to me, like I'm doing the story. And that was just sort of for little bits of color here and there. Originally, they were a little more woven into the story, but then we decided to sort of put them in a sidebar. But yeah, but that was great. And that was, I mean, the flaw of doing it the way we did it was that I had so many people come back to me to want to talk that like I literally didn't have time to talk to everybody before my deadline. So yeah, so it was. We did it sort of backwards from the way we should have done it, whereas, I should have put out the call the first week I started working on it and started with the fans and then come to the other people, come to sort of, the snarkier, more outsidery, cynical people. But it worked out okay, so.
The thing I particularly loved about your article, and for our prism and stuff, like we were very much the same as you, or perhaps with your like fandom, was like, oh, like they seem to put out good movies. Let's kind of just like, instead of like ranking them over a couple of years, let's just like knock out a podcast where we review them over like 4 years. And so, we've had a good balance with that. And it's always the thing that I find with it is like you have this idea of the super fan where they're very much that perhaps kind of Reddit style, where it's like there's only 10 movies that exist, your Lady Birds, your Moonlights, and you never hear anyone go, what did you make of The Children Act or Sydney, all these sort of the Vanishing of Sydney Halls. And your article kind of dives into it, like going, this idea that they're this perfect hit record brand is so far off from it. Like it's pretty much like 50-50, I would argue. The middle ground can be really strong, but when it's bad, it's pretty bad. And I like that your article kind of dived into that. And why do you think that like there's so much of their filmography kind of overlooked by people, like especially these super fans? Do you think there's an edit of kind of like editing kind of the brand to sort of make it all as polished as it can be? Or is it sort of something where people just naturally haven't checked them out? They only extend as far as, a handful of films potentially.
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons for this. I think the first reason is that just sort of because of the nature of the internet and streaming and everything, like there's a phrase that people on podcasts use a lot, like films that don't exist. Like it is very possible for movies with very famous people and decent budgets to sort of come out, but only in a theoretical sense, and just have no cultural impact whatsoever. And that's something I feel like that you feel that a lot of these A24 films that no one has heard of sort of do, is that the company is very good at like when they have a movie that is sort of not up to snuff, they have the ability to sort of disappear it and memory hole it. Like it's funny, a thing I noticed, like we have this festival in New York, the Tribeca Film Festival, which is sort of notorious for getting, the movies that good festival, but it's sort of notorious for getting the movies that, didn't get into Sundance, didn't get into Toronto. And it was striking going down that A24 list of like how many of these movies premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival and then were sort of dumped onto DirecTV, got no promotion whatsoever. Like, yeah, basically no, they just memory hole essentially. So yeah, so the reason that people don't really watch them or consider them part of the A24 canon is because they've been hidden, and it's very easy. If you want to hide a film these days, it's very easy to hide a film. So A24 has been sort of lucky. I mean, I don't want to, ding them. Like every studio has films that are bad, so I don't think that, it's a flaw on A24's part that, of the 100 films they've released, there's, 30 that are bad. It's hard to make a good film. But I think they've been also quite, the way that they are quite savvy about getting visibility onto their good movies, they are also very quite savvy about hiding their bad ones and sort of knowing what to do and knowing like, okay, if this is a movie that like doesn't really have a viral hook and isn't going to sort of be, the next Uncut Gems, then like we're, we are comfortable dumping it off.
Their Twitter feed is always a good indication of that, where you're like, a film's out on Friday. Don't see it existing or acknowledge that you can check out this film in cinemas right now, or it's on DirecTV or Apple TV. They'll put out a mug for it, but they will not put out a single tweet acknowledging this film. And I can imagine that being something that's frustrating for like the filmmakers and talent involved to probably have that association with A24 and then sort of just be ignored to an extent, or just sort of pushed to the side. I can imagine that being so frustrating.
Yeah, I wonder how it feels. Like, technically, you do have an A24 film, but like, it's not one of those. I don't know. I've never interviewed anybody about that, but I would be curious what they say. I mean, on the flip side, they might say like, well, we also got to make the movie we wanted to make. Like, they are right. Like, that's the sort of the flip side is they are pretty hands off, production wise. So I wonder, so that's sort of the silver lining is, you sell it to them, and if it's good, they'll give you the push. But if not, I don't know.
You really charted sort of the evolution of sort of A24 as like a brand in this kind of past 10 years. Like originally it went from like Spring Breakers, like everyone of our generation kind of remembers when that trailer kind of dropped, like that was it Skeletrix or something, like the song, and just I think everyone probably had that on their like iPods and download at the time. But they've sort of evolved over those past 10 years into very much the branding kind of exercise and thing as well, like towels, shorts, candles. It's bizarre to an extent. Do you feel that it's like been a boost to the A24 as a brand, as this quality boutique brand, or is it actually something that's kind of can be mocked? I think you highlighted really well with that like triple A24 style membership thing. Like what's kind of your feeling on the branding? How has it actually worked out for them?
I think, I don't know if this is a cop-out answer, but I think the answer is both, right? It is both worked out well for them and made them able to be mocked. But I think in a certain sense, there is almost like no such thing as bad publicity in this sense. I'm sure that, if you were to do a cost-benefit analysis, it's definitely been good for them that they have such a strong brand. I think it does, I think the first order benefit is it helps them release their films. They are releasing very, occasionally very weird movies onto a lot of screens. And the power of that brand sort of gives them an automatic buy-in that helps them. A movie like Everything Everywhere All at Once, it could have been a hit if somebody else had released it, but the fact that it was an A24 film made it easier, for it to do as well as it has, I'm sure. And the way that they were sort of very savvy about branding it with, the googly eyes and everything like that, that also I'm sure helped it. And then, second order benefit is, financially, it's the same thing with bands, right? Like when bands tour, they make all their money off the merch. Like, I'm sure that if you were running sort of, an indie studio, having a thriving merch operation probably, also is very good for the bottom line. It sort of gives you more of a cushion in case you do have, a few flops in a row. And yeah, and if the price of that is that people like me occasionally fire off snarky tweets, like I think that's a I think on the merits, they'll take a few snarky tweets. It seems like things are working out for them. I don't think they're like sad about it, is my read on it.
Why do you feel people want to wear these branded items for like a distribution company, essentially?
It's a little hard to explain because I am not one of these people, but I think it's It's one of those things where throughout, the past few decades, people have sort of liked to identify themselves with brands, especially if these brands connote something positive. And, in a 24 sense, it connotes, hipness and exclusivity and savviness and good taste in art, which is, it's something that multiple people have brought up to me, that it's the same thing as like following a record label. It is weird to follow an indie studio, but it's similarly weird to follow a record label. But 30 years ago, you would see people, wearing Sub Pop t-shirts and stuff like that. And I think they've been very savvy about sort of aligning their brand with these like very tastemaker brands, and that, their style is very minimalist. The cuts of the t-shirt sort of are, it's not just like a t-shirt you would get at a boardwalk. It's a sort of high fashion cut of t-shirt. Like they're high quality materials. They've done well to sort of make it that, like, oh, if you're wearing an A24 t-shirt, it's not the same thing as wearing, I don't know, like a New York City t-shirt that you picked up on your trip to the Empire State Building, right? It's they've managed to imbue this merch with the same sort of quality that they managed to sort of imbue their films with.
So obviously you dropped these articles both last week. I mean, a list is always going to grab attention as well, but what was kind of the reaction? Was it something you were looking forward to seeing these articles drop? And what's been the reaction? As you mentioned, it's like I saw someone complaining like, oh, brilliant article, but Climax is far too low down. What's been some of the interesting responses and to the articles? And as you mentioned, there might be a little bit of snark to it. Did anyone end up taking it ridiculously personally?
It's interesting. I was sort of curious. So I knew how the list would be perceived, right? Like you sort of have a sense of what the public's ranking of all these films is, and you sort of know when you were diverging from it. So like I knew Everything Everywhere All at Once, putting it as low as it did, it's in like the 20s. I knew that was going to be controversial, but I was also prepared for that, and I could stand by it. Like I'm happy people really like it, but it's just a movie that I like just like slightly less than it seems like other
I'm
people
the
do.
same. And I think people, like, if you're doing a listing of like 100 odd films, it's like I've had it sometimes where I've like shared mine, similar total, and it's like, oh, something at 40, that's actually still really, really good. It's like if you get to 60, a bit less so, but hey, at 40, The Witch, not a bad place to be.
Yeah, exactly. And so yes, and so that's like when people say Climax is too low, that is sort of what I would say to that is, I love Climax a lot. I think it's a great film. I just think there are 30 something films that are just like a little bit better. So that was like that was a little more predictable. There were some people that thought Bodies were too low, but I can say about it. It's like when you do a list, you sort of anticipate the reactions. It's not actually that bad. And you kind of want there, right? Like if it was. This is something that I learned, like in my old job. I used to work for People Magazine, which, if you don't know, is a very sort of like straight down the middle celebrity magazine. Very, very. It's very popular, but it's not sort of spicy in any way. And I worked on their website, and I would do lists. Just sort of, we were sort of told to sort of like do whatever we want and try it and see if it works. So I did sort of like li I did a lot of like food lists when I was there. This was like 2013, when food lists were a little more. En vogue, I guess you could say. But I did like a list of best pies, and I did a list of best nuts. And I put the best pie as apple pie, and I put the best nut as peanut. And it was just really boring. It was totally boring. Nobody read them. They weren't fun to read. They weren't that fun to write. And I was like, well, what's going on? And as when I once I moved to Vulture, I sort of sat in, and we've done these sort of big gigantic lists before with like a bunch of authors. And so we did like the best sequels, best New York City movies, et cetera, best endings. So we have these big Zoom sessions, and I am sort of a more sort of junior person in these meetings. So I mostly just sit and listen and occasionally give my opinions, but sort of watching the way that, my very smart colleagues talk about these things and the way that they formulate the list, like you do want to have some spiciness and some boldness in there. And so, yeah. And so, I tried to put some of that in the list, but then when you do that, you can't be, then you also know that you give up your right to complain when people get mad. Does that make sense? And so yeah, so people were mad, you accept that. And it was right, it's fine. Like nobody was like threatening me or anything. So that was fine. But onto the A24 Superfan list, that was one that I was more curious on. I did not know what the reaction was going to be like for that. The reaction from from everyone I spoke to has been positive, so that was good. So I interviewed everybody who reached out to me to and everyone that I spoke on the phone with. I messaged them and said, "Hey, here it is," and that was all very positive. So that was good. Like I didn't want the people I spoke to felt like I was this journalist who was calling them up and then making fun of them behind their backs, right? That I thought would be bad, but there I did get a sense, just from talking to from a little bit of a vibe that like people who other people did think that like. People the A24 fans were being made fun of in the story, which is something that maybe was a vestige of the original mission of this story, but was not what I thought it turned out to be. Like I thought when I was reading it that it's it's a fairly neutral down the line portrait of them. Most of the digs are quotes from other people, and there are quotes from A24 fans. I tried to like say nice things about A24 in the story too. So, but my theory on why that was, why people were interpreting it as more ne sort of negative than what I thought was one, like, if you just read the headline, if you just read the subhead, like those read a, just like 5% more negative than the story itself. And if that's sort of your entryway into it. And I think also if you were reading it by itself without the list, it maybe does come off as a little more negative just because like the list is filled with praise of A24, right? It's like, there are 60 blurbs that are like, this is a good movie. And so maybe, so the Superman story is kind of a counterbalance to that. It's a little less rah-rah. And so if you're just reading that without the list, I can see how sort of in a vacuum it maybe reads as slightly more negative than it does to me.
I'm curious from your perspective as like a film journalist and touching on the zeitgeist. I mean, what I find interesting about sort of A24 and sort of like charting them over a decade compared to say like Neon and Annapurna. I mean, it's looking like Neon might be getting sold. Annapurna is continuing to really kind of struggle to get back to that early 2010s peak. I mean, it felt like for a while there was that cold war between the two of them and who they were bringing in, and they've just not really recovered from kind of their financial sides. I mean, where did things kind of work out for A24 compared to kind of Neon and Annapurna?
I think this is where you see, the strength of the brand is that, even, Neon is a movie that has sort of followed the A24 playbook pretty exactly and had done it quite successfully. They won a Best Picture trophy with Parasite. They also have these sort of indie hits. But it's just a really tough out there for indie film. The economics of it, the like the margins are so slim. That it's yeah it's just very hard to survive unless you have sort of this gigantic mega corporation bankrolling you. So I think that's why like you see things like the A24 All Access program, like all the merch. Like I think there you could argue that that is the only way that A24 has been able to survive by being independent so long. Like when you compare it to studios in the past that sort of filled that same niche, like Focus Features, Searchlight, all of those were already owned by major corporations. A24 has been, they have investors, but they are fully independent. And I know there have been rumors a year or so ago, maybe 2 years, about that there was maybe a sale in the offering, but that, as far as I know, hasn't come to pass. And, maybe these efforts are the things that kind of are what's keeping them independent.
And what trends are you kind of seeing at the moment for the future of independent cinema and distributors like A24? Like, obviously just recently here in the UK, I think it's they own Regal Cinemas in America, but we sort of see Cineworld facing potential bankruptcy. The market isn't as great as people seem to think it is at the moment with cinema. What trends are you kind of seeing, and is it worrying signs for your A24s and other indie distributors?
Yeah, I mean it's very bad for everybody, which is, yeah, I mean, right, like it's they're just this is a business that was built around getting a bunch of people into a room all together. And so, obviously it makes sense that the pandemic caused, gave it so much trouble. And I think what we are seeing is that there is a conflict in that nobody has been able to come up with a business model that beats theatrical distribution in terms of, long tail revenue, in terms of like getting these movies into the cultural, giving these movies a cultural footprint, like a streaming project just doesn't have the same thing. So it's one of those things where like Wall Street is kind of convinced that theatrical is over and streaming is the future, but at the same time, the numbers say differently. But then the place where the numbers work is also the place that's been most damaged by the pandemic. And it's happening all across the industry. Fox got sold to Disney. It's a thing that's it's hurting major studios, and it's just hurting little studios even more because they're more exposed. They have less leeway. So yeah, it's going to be tough. I don't know. I'm not a I don't know if you know, but I'm not a business forecaster. But no, it's very rough out there, especially you were seeing this summer, like there's just not theaters, there's just not movies for the theaters to play. And it's really bad. It's like eating your seed corn. You want to get people into the habit of seeing movies. It's such a habit-driven business. And if you're someone who cares about movies like you and I do, like you want them to have an impact. You want them to have a cultural footprint. And they kind of only have that by playing in movie theaters. So A24, it seems like they're, pretty committed to streaming. One of the things that's good about them is they do give these weird films very wide releases. And luckily, there are tons of screens for them to play in now. So there's, in one sense, less competition. But yeah, no, exactly. It's rough times out there, and I hope they survive it, but it's going to be hard for anyone.
It feels like kind of the larger studios are and companies are sort of leaving more space for independent cinema to like arrive in the box office and potentially succeed. I mean, think of Fox slash Disney, like Pixar output is barely going into cinemas. Like a film like Prey wasn't the biggest fan of it, but that should have been in a cinema, and it's leaving that spaces for that Everything Everywhere All at Once to become a modest success. Or, I think back to the beginning of sort of cinemas reopening after the pandemic and Green Knight. In just that one weekend, there wasn't too much options there. It made 10, 15 million, budget all sorted, on it goes. It's a rare success story. Do you feel that there's sort of maybe A24 and there might be other sort of independent kind of distributors that might try and take advantage of this sort of like wide opening to maybe sort of drop these low budget films in, get some money, get out, and then might have that word of mouth to then be a success to be picked up as a iTunes rental or sold to Hulu for a little bit of money as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. I think that is precisely what they're doing, and I think you are starting to see it pay off. Like, not just with Everything Everywhere All at Once, but a film like X, which is a movie that I liked okay, but was not a movie that like seemed to me one of their like top tier releases. It sort of seemed to me like it was sort of one of their like it, pack of the middle of the pack ones. But I was surprised with how many people I spoke to that like put out X as like as a marker. It's like this is a, and I think it's the fact that like, oh no, this is a movie that came out this spring when there wasn't really that much competition for it. And so it was, if you're somebody who sees a lot of movies, like X was like kind of a biggish movie because it was playing all over the place. And it was so big that they are releasing a prequel in a few months. And so you don't think of it, it suddenly they've like launched a art house horror franchise quite seemingly accidentally, but it's like I've said, it's very rough out there, but I guess that is the silver lining that like, if these movies can catch on, they can play really well. Like as we've seen with Everything Everywhere All at Once, that was sort of them hitting it out of the park. That was everything in their business model working exactly as they intended it to.
Like you've obviously just written and reflected on the kind of the first 10 years. Where do you maybe see them in the next 10 years? This is like your big crystal ball kind of moment here.
It's interesting because I do wonder, this is something we talk about with my editors, like if your brand is cool, like how much do you have to worry about being uncool? But like if you are like the danger of being so associated with the zeitgeist of a time is that inevitably the zeitgeist move on. That's what the zeitgeist does. And then do you get left behind? So that is that is a thing that I wonder what will happen for them. Now the counter argument for them is like being cool and zeitgeist, that is part of it, but that's not the fundamental of the brand. The fundamental of the brand for them is being a place where filmmakers want to go. And if great filmmakers want to go there, then inevitably you will release great films. That was the founding math behind 70s New Hollywood too, and we saw that didn't always last because of various things, including cocaine. But if A24, if they keep the costs down and continue to be really good at marketing and sort of evolve to fit the time so that they never feel stale or stodgy, then I think they can keep a good run at it. I know that they have a lot of ambition. I know that A24 All Access is something that they are continuing to tinker with and expand and fold in new things into it. So I if you ask me where they are in 10 years, I think they still exist. I don't know if they are going to be the pop culture punchline that they are right now, just because I think, comedy also moves on. In 10 years, there will be other new things that seem quintessentially 2032 that we need to make fun of. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm optimistic for them. I think, who knows if they will still be seen as cutting edge, or if they will maybe be seen as more of the Hollywood establishment. Who knows if they'll still be independent or if they've been bought. But I think as long as they sort of continue on the fundamental mission of, there's always going to be new young filmmakers who need people to take a chance on. And as long as their taste stays good, and as long as their eye stays good, and who to back and who to pick up on, which, so far has been really good, then I think they'll still be around. I think they'll still be releasing great movies. The downside for me is I'll have to keep updating
Yeah.
the
And we have to keep doing our podcast. And
list, but
I think, I spoke about it with a guy I do this with, where I was like, I'd be worried for the future if, like, you saw it with like Bodies, 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 it comes out here next week in the UK. And like, obviously there's a discourse around it, like, oh, A24 only do these young hip movies. And I'm like, if you kind of watch these 100+ movies, it's only like the sporadic couple of times a year, those movies that come out that feel really aimed at the young kids, the teens, those like the Gen Zs. And it's like a lot of their movies are aimed at these audience that are growing older that will probably follow the brand or the title on. You have your Lovers, you have a lot of these movies where they're like, yeah, I'm not excluded from this kind of conversation, but no one seems to talk about those films, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also the nature of like who is online. Like, maybe if we were in on, maybe, and also I guess like which films get wide releases, right? I think The Lovers got maybe a small art house release, but maybe if you and I were in like Facebook groups with a bunch of California divorcees, then maybe yeah, The Lovers would have been as big as Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is. But yeah, no, I think it's right. Like, yeah, occasionally it's maybe it's like the way that bands, the Rolling Stones got to play the hits, like A24 every year. They got to have one film that just like is like red meat for terminally online Generation Z people. But I think, yeah, you're right that like it is quite a diversity, and especially when you fold in the films that disappear, that's hugely wide. Like those films are in every genre imaginable. Like you think of a film like The Exception or like Woman Walks Ahead, which are two movies that you're like, I can't, these do not feel like A24 films, but.
I often notice those films as well. They always seem very popular, those films that kind of get forgotten about in like the iTunes 99 cents like bucket bin. I often see those ones like Low Tide often appears
Oh
there,
yeah.
Women
Ooh,
Walks
yeah.
Ahead. And that for me, when I was like trying to film, get off the film, it was like 99 cents this week, that's the film that's getting watched and so on. That's where they seem to find a little happy home.
I have a question for you in that, so A24, do they operate in the UK? Like as far as you know, they're only US distribution, but I guess they are a production company. So
So, like, say you're Midsommar, A24 produced, like, Universal will release it here. Like, last week, like, after months and months after Yang is coming out in the UK, and that's coming out through Sky Movies. So, we had it as part of, like, the Edinburgh Film Festival last week. So, we had the chance to interview, like, Kuganda, Justin H. Min, and, like, that's a Sky Movies release, but A24, they're the production company on it. But what's kind of interesting and something we're keen to chart is that Everything Everywhere All at Once was meant to be Sky Movies, which is basically like a glorified cable channel here. It does like your sports, movies, they have the odd film release, and it's often probably the equivalent of DirecTV. Like, they're not good stuff. So Everything Everywhere All at Once was meant to be them. And it was like a month or two after the States it was meant to come out here. And we had friends that were like, you know what, we should just like hire like a cheap little cinema screen. Like, let's watch this film the way it should be, not on like crappy TV.
Yeah.
But A24 is starting to, like, they've got a little office here in the UK. And I think they kind of felt like the way the wind was going with that film. And we're like, actually, we're cancelling the Sky deal and we will put it out into cinemas. So it got the IMAX release here. It went into multiplexes. The Daniels came over and there was like Edgar Wright would host them for like question and answer sessions at like the BFI, for example. So that's their, so far, their one and only film. Like Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is like Sony after Yang. Is that like, there's no word on like Marcel the Shell coming out here yet. So there's like a couple where it's still in a weird limbo stage. So for a lot of their films, you could, like Ex Machina, you don't get the A24 logo here. You just get Film 4 or Under the Skin.
Because it was, right, I believe that was a British film that they picked up, right? So that makes sense.
Yeah, so like Lovers was their first one that they ever produced, and then it's gone from there. So like the A24 logo is something you would more see with like trailers if you were online, but it took probably until halfway through their, you know, life cycle to be something you would recognize in cinemas here. So yeah, it's definitely been quite interesting charting what they're maybe going to start doing in the UK for sure. And in terms of like yourself, what are you kind of working on at the moment? Are you sitting there working on another big 2-year super list? What's kind of the next thing for you, Nate?
So no, luckily no. Although, you know, one of the things about a list like this is you sort of consign yourself to every few months having to update it. And that is, you know, the editor comes around in Slack and says, okay, like it's time. Luckily, I've been to some of the festivals, so I've seen a fair amount of their unreleased films. So I have sort of blurbs in the bank for a few of the ones that are still to come. And next week I'm heading to Toronto. So I will be covering the Toronto Film Festival, and a bunch of A24 films are also playing there. So I could, you know, get caught up on some of these. So my main thing is the Oscar race. So that, you know, Labor Day weekend, this coming weekend, is sort of the starting gun for the Oscar race. So the next 6 months are sort of going to be mostly that. But then in the middle, we're doing, you know, sort of tangentially connected to A24 in a way. We're doing a whole package on nepotism. Which, as you notice, you know, A24, they love to hire the child of a famous person.
Yeah. You can see Euphoria here.
Yeah. But yeah, so we're doing a little nepotism package in a few weeks. So I'm working on that. And then, I will have to find some time in there to re-listen to all the new Taylor Swift songs and the old ones and sort of do a top to bottom re-ranking of that one. So yeah.
Well, for those that want to kind of like check out your work or follow you kind of online, where can you recommend people to go?
Yeah, I would recommend that they follow me on Twitter at KN8. So that is the letter K, the letter N, and the number 8. I've got a 3-character Twitter bio, which is, you know, quite nice. And just follow me on Vulture. There's, you know, I have an author page there. If you just search Nate Jones Vulture, you'll see everything that I write.
And if people don't have time to read like your thoughts on 124 films, there's always your Batman Chins like list that they can go through. You can go through that one quite quickly.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Nate. It's honestly been a real pleasure to talk to the twisted mind behind the A24 college article. Like, I really enjoyed it.
The poisoned brain.
Yeah, it was absolute pleasure to read it, and as to read someone that's gone through a very similar journey to us, I think it's hard not to go through their filmography and share similar thoughts and reactions. So yeah, it felt like a like-minded individual as I read the article.
No doubt. I'm curious to see like how your project continues and evolves over the.
Well, I'll just say it. The Children Act was the only film I thought was rated far too high. That is like the bottom for me. So
the Children, it's like, it's not the bottom. It's just like totally medium. It's, I guess they say mid. Kids would
it's
say
that
mid.
Annoying character in it. The young kid couldn't stand it. When I had to rewatch it for this. Yeah. Oh, dreadful. I couldn't stand that character.
The wee Dunkirk lad.
Yeah. Oh, terrible. But thank you so much, Nate. I really appreciate you coming on and so on. And yeah, it was an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you for having me.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.